Tanya 200. We were discussing the difference between the godliness produced through the study of Torah and the godliness produced through the performance and the act of a mitzvah. And we were saying that the godliness produced through the act of a mitzvah is greater, more essential to the plan for which God created the world than the godliness produced through the study of Torah. Because God's plan and desire in creating the world was to make a dwelling place, to make a godly home out of the lowest world, the physical, the mundane, the unholy. And by doing mitzvahs, we bring about that transformation, because in the act of the mitzvah, we involve the lower parts of our soul, the action, and the body itself in the act of the mitzvah, and the physical object with which we perform the mitzvah. The leather for the tefillin, or the mezuzah, the candle that we light for Shabbos, and so on. Every mitzvah involves a physical object. There is also a greatness to the study of Torah. And that's why the sages say that the study of Torah is equal or is greater than all the other mitzvahs. What makes the study of Torah greater? In the study of Torah, God's will is so much more revealed. It is so much more obvious. Because what we're reading and what we're saying is God's thought and God's will. In the act of the mitzvah, there's a little bit of a distraction or of a concealment, because we're dealing with physical objects that are, of course, fulfilling God's will, but it's not as obvious, because you're noticing the physical object. So in the study of Torah, we're actually engaging God's mind, whereas in the act of the mitzvah, we're engaging God's will. So the act of the mitzvah is in Kabbalah compared to the limbs of the king, whereas Torah is compared to the mind of the king. Torah is God's mind. And when we immerse ourselves properly in the study of Torah, we're literally engaging in the godliness that is God's thought and God's wisdom, God's thinking. And that's why the expression used to describe the study of Torah in many places is Kodesh B'Torah, which literally means to read the Torah, but it also means to call. Kore means to call. Because every time we study Torah, any part of Torah, we are in effect calling God, calling His attention, asking Him to join us, to come closer, to be with us, and not allow us to be alone, to be separated from Him, like a child calling to his father because he doesn't want to be alone. In calling to God, we are getting God's attention. And every time we study Torah, we are calling to God, and He turns His attention to us. And the Rebbe says that from this, every person can appreciate how awesome the study of Torah is, and with what kind of reverence we should study the Torah, being aware of the fact that every time you read or explain or debate a statement in Torah, a verse in Torah, it's literally like calling God and getting His attention. There's a whole story that illustrates this very well. The third Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Tzemach Tzedek, was the grandson of the Alter Rebbe, who is the author of the Tanya that we're studying. When he was a very little boy, he was sitting on his grandfather's lap, on the Alter Rebbe's lap. And playfully, wistfully, he was holding the Alter Rebbe's lapel and saying, Zayde, grandpa. And the Alter Rebbe said, that's not the Zayde, that's a lapel, that's a jacket. So the little boy stroked his grandfather's beard, and he said, Zayde. And his grandfather said, that's not Zayde, that's a beard, that's hair. A little while later, the boy was playing in the room behind his grandfather, and he called out, Zayde, and the grandfather turned around, and the little boy said, ah, there's the Zayde. The response to the name or the title, when his grandfather turned around in response to being called, that response, that's the real inner being of the Zayde, not the outer trappings. When we study Torah, we're actually calling God by his first name, and we always get a response, and that's really God, not just his creations or his angels. That's really him. And so the study of Torah is greater than all other mitzvahs in the kind of godliness that we're engaging, the kind of godliness that we're experiencing, which is much greater than the godliness we experience in the act of a mitzvah. Because the act of a mitzvah is more like the body rather than the personality of God. But on the other hand, as we said at length in the earlier chapters, it's precisely the body, it's precisely the creation, the physical, the mundane, that God is interested in, and when that becomes godly, even though it may not be apparent today as we do the mitzvah, but when that becomes godly, the godliness transcends and is greater even than the godliness in the study of Torah. And that, in chapter 38, the Rebbe says, that explains why the intentions, the best intentions, the deepest kavana that a person will have in, say, the words of the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, does not fulfill the obligation. He has to actually say the words, pronounce them with his mouth. And that's because the intention involves the soul, whereas the words, saying it out loud, involves the body and the animal soul. And since the godly soul does not need improving, and the godly soul does not come into this world in order to perfect itself or to improve itself, it is here only to elevate the physical, the animal, the natural soul. That's why it has to involve at least the movement of the lips, which is in some way an act that involves the body, in order that the body become godly, which is the truest purpose or the deepest purpose for which God created the world. Now, in understanding the difference between the intention of the mitzvah, the motivation, the feelings, the experience, the internal experience of the mitzvah versus the act of the mitzvah, the simple doing of the act. To understand that, the Rebbe says that when God created the world, all of creation is possible because God invests himself in the creation, while at the same time, in order for physical existence to be possible, God has to be concealing himself as he invests himself. So he has to be intimately involved in creation, but he also has to be concealed and mysterious in the act of creation, so that he not be too obvious. Now this concealment does not make him any less present, but less observable, less obvious. And in the concealment, there are varying degrees. In certain creations, God is more concealed, more restricted, and in others, less concealed or restricted. Generally, we can break this into four categories. There is the inanimate kingdom, the inanimate object, where godliness is very concealed. Even the inanimate object, even the stone, the mineral, has an energy, a spark, a life that keeps it from returning to nothingness. It keeps it in existence. But that life is very minimal, and therefore godliness, which is the essence of life, is very concealed, very restricted in the inanimate object. In the vegetable world, the presence of life and of creator is a little more obvious because there's growth. Then there's the kingdom of the animal, where there's more life, there's activity, there's all sorts of behavior, which shows a greater degree of life and of energy. And so the creator is a little less concealed there. And then finally, in the human being, where there is intelligence and volition, freedom of choice, here God is even less concealed than in the animal kingdom. Now, within the human being, we have these four states or these four kingdoms. A person who doesn't act without any awareness, without any intention at all, is functioning on a mineral level. He's alive, but there isn't much energy to it. It's simply the act of the mitzvah. If a person has a little bit more energy, a little more motivation, it becomes like a growing thing, more like the vegetable state. Then, in the intention of the mitzvah, where there is great intention, there are also two possibilities. There's the animal and the human. The animal possibility is when a person does not understand godliness, is not moved by his wisdom to appreciate the greatness of God and therefore experience a deep love for God in the active part of the heart, an actual love. Instead, what he does is he gets inspired by the love and connection and commitment to God that comes natural, that we inherit from our patriarchs, which we are born with. As the Alter Rebbe was quoted, often quoted, a Jew can't be separated from God, nor does he want to be separated from God, because of a natural inherited love, a relationship in which we are born into. Now that does not come as a result of our understanding God, of our wisdom, of our study, of our contemplation. It exists on the emotional level without even involving the mind. And that's more like the animal plane, where animals have strong feelings, but they're inherited. They weren't developed through study or through freedom of choice. Then there's the level of service, in which a person prays, for example, and says the words of the prayer, coming from an inspired love, not an inherited love, which comes from an understanding of God, from the pursuit of godliness, which comes through free choice, through volition. And as a result, the emotion is a product of intelligence, is self-created or self-generated rather than inherited from the patriarchs. Now, obviously, the intention, the kavana, on that level is much greater and therefore reveals more life, more energy, and more godliness than when you do the mitzvah or say the words of the prayer without any intention at all, which is more like the mineral level. And so the kavana, the intention, is what allows us to see the godliness more readily than when we do a mitzvah without intention, where the concealment is much greater. So in terms of revelation, in terms of visibility, when a person is saying the words of the prayers with intention, and with the greatest of intention, the volition, the intelligent love that comes from study, rather than the inherited love that comes naturally, there we are witness to the godliness of these words of the prayer. Whereas when a person is saying the words of the prayer without great intention, without great appreciation, without great love and awe, the godliness is still there, but we don't witness it. The concealment is greater. And that's why the relationship between the intention of the mitzvah and the mitzvah itself is sometimes described as the bird and its wings. The intention are the wings. The wings enable a bird to fly, to rise, to soar. Without the intention, without the kavana, the bird can't soar, can't fly. There's no visible activity that would identify it as a bird. But on the other hand, in fact, a bird without wings is still a bird, is as much a bird as the one with wings. It is the same creature, the same character, the same being, only it doesn't fly. So when you do a mitzvah without kavana, it's like a bird without wings. It doesn't soar, it doesn't fly, it doesn't float. But it is a mitzvah. And if we were to do the reverse comparison, what is the intention of a mitzvah without its performance? What would we compare that to? That would obviously be wings of a bird without the bird itself. Now, a bird without wings is a living creature. And there are all sorts of mitzvahs and commandments that apply to a living creature. You have to feed the animal before you feed yourself. You're not allowed to be cruel to an animal. You're not allowed to drink the blood of the animal. There are sacrifices that can be performed with a kosher animal. So an animal, a living being, is a very significant creature, even without its wings. On the other hand, wings without a bird, there are no mitzvahs associated with that. We have no obligation, we have no commandments, we have no responsibility to a bunch of feathers, which is what wings are when they're not connected to a bird. So when we do the mitzvah, even if we don't have the proper intentions, we have a vital, living mitzvah. Only we don't see it flying, we don't see it soaring. Its godliness and its value are concealed. But if a person were to sit and deeply concentrate on the significance of the mitzvah, or of the words of the Shema, for example, without saying the words, so he's not fulfilling the mitzvah, he's only appreciating it in his intention and in his mind, then what we have is feathers, wings, without the bird. So the significance, the greatness of the act of the mitzvah, which of course involves physical objects, or at least physical parts of the body, even in speech, where you don't have a physical object, but it's the physical mouth, the five, what are they called? The five tools of articulation. The lips, the gums, the palate, the teeth, the tongue. All of this is very physical. And when the physical performs the mitzvah, even if the kavana is missing, it is a vital, living mitzvah, an essential piece of godliness, which unfortunately we will not appreciate readily because the kavana is not there, because the intention is not there. So the intention enables us to see the godliness more readily, reveal the godliness to a greater degree. But revealing has to apply to something godly. We can't reveal if there's nothing to reveal. So to have the kavana, the intention, without the actual mitzvah, we're thinking godliness, but we're not actually engaging in anything godly. We're conscious of godliness, but we're not involved in godliness until we do the actual mitzvah. And so this kind of sums up the concept of making a dwelling place for God in the lower world. And this is all in response to the question, in answer of the question, what justifies sending a godly soul from the highest of heavens into the physical world, not only to engage in contest, in struggle, the unholiness of this world, but to be intimately connected and dependent on an animal soul, on a body, into which the soul is invested, and to share the experience of 80 or 90 or 100 years of life with the body and the animal soul, to where the godly soul and the body are inseparable. Why this kind of investment? Why does the soul have to be so intimately invested in the physical? By the same token, the question can be asked about God himself. God is intimately invested in the physical. The Shechina, which is the part of God that is present in the world, is called Shechina because Shechina means indwelling. It's not just that God is present in the world, but that he is absorbed in the world. And the question is, if God wants to fix a bad world, does he have to be so absorbed? Does he have to be so invested? Can't he do it from a distance? If the godly soul is here to struggle against the animal soul and defeat the animal soul, does it have to be in such close quarters? Does it have to be so intimately invested in the animal soul, in the body? Why can't the struggle be from a distance? And the answer is, the idea is not to defeat the evil. Of course, there is the unredeemable evil that can only be defeated and rejected. But most of the world, most of creation, is not evil or sinful or forbidden. Most of the world is permissible but ungodly. And there, the objective is not to reject it or to destroy it. There, the objective is to draft it into the service of God, to absorb it into godliness, to unite it by elevating it with godliness and turning it into a divine dwelling place, a home for God. In order to do that, the godly soul has to be invested, has to be at close quarters with the animal soul to elevate it, to absorb it, to draw it into the godliness that the godly soul has. And the way to do that, of course, is only through the act of the mitzvah, where the mitzvah is godliness, and the act of the mitzvah involves the body in the godliness of the mitzvah. So in order for the animal soul, which is not sinful, it's not the evil inclination, it's the animal soul, which is unholy, but not forbidden, not unredeemable. So if a person uses the body, the animal soul, and the physical object that are permissible, they're neutral, kosher food can be used in a godly fashion. Legally obtained money can can be used to give to charity. So when it doesn't involve any sin, when there's none of the 365 prohibited acts being violated, then the body or the soul is safe from the corrupting influence of these 365 prohibitions, very much like the 365 arteries of the body. You can't do much with your arteries. It's the organs of the body that do the work and that you use in activities. The arteries simply need to be kept clean. For a healthy body, the cleaner the arteries are, the healthier the body will be, and the better the organs will be able to function and do what they're created to do. The 365 prohibitions out of the 613 commandments, there are 365 prohibited activities. This corresponds to the 365 arteries of the body. There are also 248 limbs of the body, which correspond to the 248 positive commandments out of the 613. So the positive commandments, the things you get up and do, that those are the organs, the limbs of the body. The 365 prohibitions, the things that we should not do, we avoid because they clog the arteries, the spiritual arteries. And when a person has committed one of the 365 prohibitions, it blocks the flow of godliness, it blocks the flow of life in the soul, so that it interferes with the body's function, so that the limbs can't do what they need to do until you clean out the arteries, which means until you return, tshuva, you return, you get rid of the unholiness. You clean away the obstruction so that life can flow again to all the limbs of the body with which we perform the mitzvahs, which in turn, according to Kabbalah, correspond to the 248 limbs of the king, the ways through which God finds expression of the Shekhinah in the physical world.